Welcome to New World Notes. I remain Kenneth Doust. Today we'll hear the second half of a terrific talk Michael Parenti gave in Guelph, Ontario, on November 2nd. It's about American imperialism and why it exists, and how the empire destroys the underlying republic. And part two today ends with some practical advice on things we can do to stop the monster of imperialism from devouring us, and the rest of the world as well. A key insight of Parenti's is that the American empire does not exist for the greater glory of the nation-state, the United States of America. Rather, the American empire is but a tool to aid the plutocrats in plundering all the resources of the world for their personal gain. By way of proof, Parenti begins with a catalog of governments the U.S. forces have overthrown, and countries invaded or bombed into submission over the past generation. In every case, the U.S. government proclaimed a noble purpose to the unprovoked aggression: protecting civilian lives, spreading democracy, preventing a nuclear attack, removing a tyrant, and so on. In every case, the real purpose was stopping another country from maintaining some economic independence, stopping it from resisting laying its wealth open to plunder by the huge corporations and their owners, the plutocrats. This is true of Iraq under Saddam Hussein, Libya, Haiti under Aristide, twice, Honduras under Zelaya, anybody remember that recent coup? And Iran. Parenti gives a dozen examples, and it's not hard to think of a dozen more. Panama, twice, Grenada. Explaining the American empire to Canadians, here is Michael Parenti.
I argue that the U.S. empire builders are very rational. They're very successful. They know what they're doing. They consistently support those dictators or democratically elected governments that follow the New World Order of free market capitalism. They consistently oppose those dictators or democratic governments, movements, people, whatever, that seek an alternative to free market capitalism, that seek economic self-development, communal development. And that's true of the New Jewel movement in Grenada. The Gaddafi's real sins in Libya was that he would not bring the IMF in. He did that. He built that aquifer system, which brought that fresh water up to the north, where most of the people of Libya live, fresh water for the farms and for themselves. He kicked the oil companies out, and he took the earnings from those oil companies, and he built free housing for the Libyan people, free education, and free health care. Whatever else he did, whatever his other sins were, that isn't what the West was concerned. They weren't concerned about that. Look, right next door to him was another dictator, Mubarak. And right down almost to the last day, Obama and Hillary were defending Mubarak. For 30 years, I heard about Mubarak in Egypt, and all I ever heard him referred to in the U.S. media was President Mubarak. President Mubarak was one of the most repressive regimes, but he was President Mubarak, whereas Gaddafi was, commander or dictator or whatever else like that. Milosevic of Yugoslavia, who could not get convicted by that tribunal in The Hague. It wasn't the World Court. It's just that trumped-up tribunal that the British and the Americans set up to try him. When the top jurist in The Hague, Carla del Ponte, said, 2 years of prosecution, we don't have a case against this guy. There's nothing we can put him in jail about. There were no mass slaughters. There were no 100,000 bodies buried in Kosovo. You took over Kosovo. Where are the bodies and all? But that kind of stuff was pumped out, and we had people, even progressives and even people who consider themselves on the left, there they were standing shoulder to shoulder with the CIA and the Pentagon and NATO and the very same mass media they always tell us don't believe and take it with a grain of salt and watch what you're reading and all that. And there they were standing shoulder to shoulder with them fighting the whatever it was, the last Stalinist, whatever they thought he was. democratically elected in Yugoslavia, in Yugoslavia's first democratic election. Noriega of Panama, Chavez of Venezuela is called a firebrand, a barracks populist, whatever that's supposed to mean and such, and hostile to America. Aristide in Haiti, twice democratically elected and deposed by the U.S. and driven out of his own country. Allende in Chile, killed. Zelaya in Honduras, whom Obama sold right down the river. Because, and what it was Zelaya's sin in Honduras? He wanted to raise the minimum wage by about 10 cents an hour. And the military went against him and kicked him out. And you can go on and on with these things. Saddam Hussein is a very interesting case. There's your control group if you want to experiment. Saddam Hussein was CIA. You know, back in the late 50s, early 60s, Iraq had this revolution and had this democratically elected coalition government. And Saddam Hussein's first gig under the CIA was to go and murder the prime minister, the democratically elected prime minister of Iraq. And today, when they go in and say, we come to Iraq to teach these poor little backwood people how to run a democracy, they forget they had a democracy 20 years before. This is a 5,000-year civilization. We're going to come in and teach them how to really survive and tie their shoelaces and that sort of thing. Okay, within about 10 years, they got Saddam Hussein to head the Ba'athist Party with enough killings, with enough money, with enough recruitment of strong arms and such. And he came into office, and Saddam Hussein came into office. He murdered or drove into exile or drove underground every constitutionalist, every Democrat, every communist, every socialist, every reformer in Iraq. That's what he did. And when he was doing that, some of the most horrible tortures and murders, he was Washington's poster boy. They loved him. They couldn't get enough of him. They take their pictures with him. They sent him aid. They signed him into war against Iran. They gave him special this and special that and all that. Then he started doing some very funny and unforgivable things. Do you know what he did? He committed economic nationalism. He refused to privatize everything. He kept the entire economy state-owned. Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, U.S., said, "It looks like a Stalinist economy." I was amused by the use of that term. A Stalinist economy. He kept everything national. He started educating engineers, cadres. Women were going to school. He kept a lot of the reforms of the former democracy. And they were saying, hey, why do we kill all these people and jack him in there when he's carrying out some of the same programs that they had? And he refused to give the oil companies back their oil. Their oil, which the Iraqis very inconsiderately and selfishly had buried in their own ground. So what did they do? They bombed him and they destroyed him and the like. But isn't that interesting? Now here you're controlling for the very same person. And you see, if he's doing these set of actions, which I said are called friendship, pro-American, democratic, healthy, it's okay. When he does these sets of actions, and in fact, in the second stage, he did much less murdering and killing, relatively little. He was like improving himself, and who the hell wants that as your ally? What use is that? Is he going soft on us? Well, how do the American builders get the American people, American empire builders? How do they get the American people to go along with all of this? No jokes from you Canadians now, okay? Let me just talk about... I know that there's a great show. It used to be... One of its segments was called Talking with Americans. Do you know the show? I mean, I forget the guy's name. And you heartless Canadians used to come down to the U.S. and used to interview Americans about things, you know? I think they even interviewed President George Bush himself. They said, President Bush, the Canadian president, already a joke, the Canadian president, Tim Horton, sends his regards. And Bush said, oh, say hello to President Horton for me. Oh, haven't seen him in quite a while, yeah. And then they did a survey. They went around, they said to Americans, You know, the Canadians are killing all of our silverfish. You know what silverfish are? There's like these little roaches that you find in the bathtub. You're supposed to whack them, and they're vermin. And people say, oh, we got to stop them from doing that. So I love the show, but but it's pretty bad when the Empire does it, you know, and plays tricks. Mostly, there are messianic appeals to we are God's gift to humanity, and we've got to help, and we've got to do this, and we have the power, therefore we have the responsibility. There's that kind of talk. And Americans really don't bite at that much, really. But in fact, the thing that works is using the fear, convincing them that they are beset by enemies and political demons from abroad, and they are in danger. And that's what happened with Saddam Hussein when they decided they were going to destroy him. And the polls were showing like 75-80% of Americans were against committing American troops in Kuwait and the first Gulf War and all that. They said, why the hell we should go there? I'm not going to support some war like that. I'm worried about paying my rent and keeping my job. What's this all about? Well, then they started saying, what if Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons? The phrase weapons of mass destruction had not yet come into vogue in 1991. They said nuclear weapons, which he might use. Well, you know, it's like saying, what if someone has a gun to your head? Are you going to feel comfortable about it? Or what? So then, if you can incite enough people with fear that their homes are endangered, their children are endangered and all that, then they are willing to hand over their tax dollars and their rights to those who would wage wars. For years, we saw that. I was raised in that. It was called saving the world from communism. Communism everywhere, communism in schools, communism in Hollywood, communism under your bed, your mama, communism going to get your mama, you know. You got to worry about communism. And we lived in this fear of the ruthless, power-hungry communists who were overthrown after a few demonstrations. And there was a panicky period in the early to mid-90s where the plutocracy and the global empire builders who had said, we need this enormous budget, we need these global empire, we need all these bases to contain the Soviet Union. Well, the Soviet Union was gone now. It's very rare when history operates like a laboratory experiment. You know, you can remove the one, have a control and remove the one vital component or ingredient and then retest it without that. But there it was gone. And you know what happened? The U.S. military budget grew at a faster rate than ever. The number of military bases increased at a faster rate than ever. We now have bases, major bases in Kyrgyzstan, in Central Asia, where 15 years ago, no American policymaker even dreamed that we could have a base there. And now we got bases there. That was a part of the Soviet Union. It isn't. So here's the danger now. We've run out of enemies. What do we do? How do we keep the American people frightened enough? And thank God it came along, the war on terror. Now, the war on terror had been going on before. It was always ascribed to the Soviets, a world network of terrorism with its headquarters in Moscow, was the phrase that Claire Rising was always using. No, not Claire Rising. I'm sorry. Strike that. Edit this film now. Well, the imperialists cannot tell the American public that we want you to die for the free market. Die to make the world safe for the Fortune 500 and the super rich. So they say they're involved, they go in because of humanitarian considerations or to ward off an aggressor or defend our national security, to free a country from a tyrant, to fight terrorism and all that stuff. And since the end of the Soviet Union, since then the U.S. has invaded Panama, they've invaded Haiti, they've invaded Somalia, they destroyed Yugoslavia, they invaded Afghanistan. They invaded and occupied Iraq and have destroyed it for the most part. They're destroying Libya, another, which will soon probably emerge as another militant extremist Islamic base. The empire sees only two types of states beyond its borders. I discussed this in the book too. Vassal states, or what we often call client states or satellites. And that includes our allies. The allies, of course, you give them a little more room, but they go along pretty much, or they never interfere with us if we're going to bomb a country in Europe. Whoever knew that a country in Europe was going to be destroyed by aerial war, that's Yugoslavia, and they went along, they looked the other way, some of them, and others actually participated. Or the other kind of state is an enemy state or potential enemy. Every state that is not a vassal or a satellite of the U.S. Empire is potentially an enemy. Some of them, just because of their sheer size, they cannot be that readily bludgeoned. Russia would be an example. Also because they have nuclear weapons, and therefore we can't bomb them as we can bomb Libya, as we will be bombing Iran soon, which I think they would have been doing by now if it weren't for the Arab Spring and all that agitation that had been going on. So think of that when you do demonstrations. Does it have any effect or impact? It does deter them. It does give them moments of hesitations and such. And China is another example of a country. China is about the only country in the world that's not afraid of the United States. And they make it known now, you know. I mean, when you got a $1 trillion debt note on the U.S., when you're outproducing, when the U.S. economy is at zero growth and you're doing 8%, although that bubble may burst, because capitalism has its wastes and irrationalities, even in a controlled situation, relatively controlled situation like China. The Chinese don't have a single soldier on foreign soil. Remember that. They have troops in Tibet. They've had troops in Tibet for 1,000 years, by the way. They don't see this as a sudden aggrandizement or anything like that. And the Tibetan ruling elites always welcomed the Chinese, a Mongolian Chinese troop force. What they didn't like about the last one in 52 was that it was communist and it wanted reforms like land reform, the end of slavery, and the end of serfdom. And that didn't sit well at all with the religious and secular elites of Tibet. But China doesn't have bases all over the world. It doesn't have fleets going everywhere. And they're not afraid of the Americans. They say, so you got 300 million, we got 1.2 billion people. So you got nuclear weapons? Well, we got nuclear weapons too, and we got them targeted, you know, and they get let loose like yours can get let loose. That during that dispute in the China South Sea there, you know, where China and Malaysia and Taiwan and Vietnam are all arguing about the oil reserves, and the U.S. came along and said, we will give our good officers and adjudicate this thing. And the Chinese said, who the hell asked you? You know, get the hell out of here. You have no historical claim or link here. Just get out of here. And that was that. It was very interesting. You look in Africa now, you know, the U.S. corporations go in and their goal is to do what? Destroy all the communal farming, destroy whatever they can, grab everything they can and get the hell out, leave the people poor and go out rich. The Chinese come in and they say, what? What do you need? Improvements in your port? We'll do the improvements. What do you need? Some roads here, there? We'll build them for you. Now give us a contract on your minerals and such and the like. And they're very popular in some parts of Africa. So China is a potential enemy. And when Obama gets up and does his State of the Union, he starts with our rivalry with China. And I say, wait a minute, who's right? I got no rivalry with China. I'm not in no race against the Chinese. I'm not. What is this? What is this stuff, you see? Let me just make two last points, then I'll stop. Maybe three. The empire feeds off the republic. The empire gets its immense wealth. It's a very costly affair to police the whole world. And the global military power is stronger than ever. The Pentagon is stronger than ever, and the republic is poorer and more depleted than ever. You have, as I've already said, indebted states and municipalities and such, closing hospitals, closing schools and libraries. There's a number of books written about how the U.S. empire is in decline. I don't see that. Did I miss something? I don't see it as in decline. The republic is in decline. I mean, that's for sure. And you shouldn't confuse the two. Now there's whole-scale resistance. But it is also true that the empire, like any parasite, can kill its host if it feeds and feeds and feeds. The republic, if the republic collapses, the empire doesn't get enough. What to do? Well, I think the alternative is socialism. Oh, come on, didn't socialism have its day? What are you talking about? Well, stop thinking about socialism and capitalism as two great epic armies that have somehow clashed, and socialism has been shattered, and capitalism rules supreme around the world. There is no alternative. That's the way they want you to think about it. But just look around in your own society, even in the U.S., which where you have whole populations who begin to shake and you know, go crazy if they hear the word socialism. I remember a worker that I knew up in Vermont, and I showed, we had a party called the Liberty Union Party back in the early 70s. I ran for Congress in Vermont. The guy on our ticket who ran for the Senate was named Bernie Sanders, and he is now senator from Vermont. I mean, he then later became mayor of Burlington and then congressman and then senator. It has only one congressman, Vermont, a small state. And I knew this guy well, and I showed, look, this is the program. This is everything we'd want to go. And he's looking, reading. He said, this is terrific. The only thing I don't like is this last line. You say, this will bring us to socialism. I don't like socialism. I don't want any socialism. He wanted all the substance of socialism, but he didn't want the word, you know, because he was trained. They salivate negatively when they hear the bell, socialism. And I want socialism because it does work. It may not work in everything, in every kind of area. There are certain kinds of specialty services and such where you don't want the state running, like, you may not want the state running the plumbing industry, so you wait three days for a plumber to come. I'm thinking about Cuba right now. But socialism has worked. Healthcare is better under socialism. The French healthcare, the Finnish healthcare, Swedish healthcare, much better than the U.S. healthcare that was. Education. Socialism. I taught at the State University of New York many years ago. I'm a recovering academic, I tell people now. But I taught there, and I remember students saying, but what would socialism do? How does it work? I can't even imagine it. I said, you can't imagine it. You're sitting in it right now. This university is socialist. It's not run for a profit. It's run by the community. It's run by public funding. And utilities, the publicly owned utilities in America are better run. The money they earn goes into the public budget. It doesn't go into private pockets of big plutocrats. We have private utilities in some areas. We have public utilities. I live in Northern California where you have the biggest, most powerful private utility. It's called Pacific Gas Electric, what is it, PG&E. And we pay the highest rates in the country. And it's a private company. So you pay more, and you get more dangerous service. It's the same company that gave us the San Bruno explosions just about 5-10 miles from where I live, which killed 8 people and destroyed about 40 homes, just blew them away. In midday, when luckily not that many people were home, only 8 were killed and such. And there's investigations of it and all that, but PG&E is still there. So I want socialism that can save lives and the like. Transportation, public transportation is always better. The one state in the U.S. that had a relatively more stable and less drastic economic financial recession was North Dakota. And North Dakota is the only state in the union that has state banks. So that means the public funds and all this money, these millions of dollars, go into a state bank, and they earn money not for the rich bankers, but for the public itself. When public programs don't work, it's usually because they're defunded and they're deprived of enough money to really to carry out the work that they could do. So there we are. The Occupy movement that we see today is most explicitly ideologically advanced. I think it's terrific. It's a very good movement. The signs say things like, you know, down with capitalism, or we can't afford capitalism, and we need socialism, and talk about the 1% and the 99%. That's a devilishly clever and simple thing to finally do, just the 1%. You know, it's not even 1%. I mean, 1% of the U.S. population is over 3 million people. The super rich are really about 240,000 individuals, and they really are super rich. If you look at the chart and how the income goes, when you get to that last fraction, it's about a 0.004. It's like a fraction of 1%. It shoots up. It would shoot up into the stratosphere, beyond this ceiling. If I made a chart on the board, it would take weeks and days and helicopters and everything to get it all the way up to the top. No, it's really true. I saw an article in the New York Times about the rich and what they're doing and all that, and they show this house, very nice house. I said, that's not the rich. That's not the super rich. That's not who owns America and most of the world. That's not the group that has $1.2 trillion in personal wealth. I said, that's not them. Houses like that, I can go from my little cottage all the way up the hill, up to the hills in East Berkeley, and I can find houses like that. And they'll go for $1 million, $1.5 million, but that's not the super rich. Even when they talk about the rich, they have no idea how rich the rich really are. The rich live in homes that you can't take pictures of, unless you're up in a press helicopter and you shoot from that. Otherwise, you know, you'll be shot by the guards or the security force things. They live on estates and the like. So we've got to become aware of the extent to which these things happen, and the Occupy actions are excellent. We have to move to demonstrations. Demonstrations are important. They highlight issues that have long been buried. They mobilize numbers. They give a show of strength. In other words, they give a show of muscle to an opinion, to a stance. See, the media do not only control opinions. In fact, they don't always control opinions, but they control opinion visibility. And so that becomes the frustration, that our opinion gets no visibility. And what's happened, we have suddenly broken through that cloud to some degree. And of course, they're still obfuscating it and trivializing it and snickering at it and the like, which is what their job is to do, the corporate media. That's why they work for the corporate media. But demonstrations should also evolve into other forms of action, civil disobedience, organizing unions and such. One of the wonderful aspects of the Occupy movement is those places where unions have come in. Workers, Teamsters, nurses, teachers have moved in and lent support, and sometimes financial support too. Refusal to serve in the armed forces, that's a weak point of the empire. The empire has a manpower shortage, that's why Obama waxes ecstatic over the drones. Like, you can kill people without risking any American lives. They just go in automatically, and they can shoot and wipe out villages, you know. All right, so there's some collateral damage and the like. We need new electoral strategies. We need a constitutional convention so that we can have an egalitarian democracy and not a rigmarole obstacle course democracy. If you ever take American government, you know what I'm talking about. We need ideological education. We really have to advance the ideological consciousness. And that means when you see these things and you see how they come together, you can connect them and you can see why it's not just all confusion and buzzing, booming, blooming chaos. Why, in fact, there are real consistencies there and you're able to organize this data into a real analysis. And I hope I gave you some bit of a real analysis tonight. Thank you for being so courteous.
Michael Parenti. He ended with a surprisingly clear call for socialism. Maybe the word scares Canadians less than it does us Yankees. But when you think about it, my cup of coffee here is made from water brought into my house by socialism. I walk, bicycle, and drive along roads built and maintained by socialism. And what could be more socialistic than social security, public schools, public parks, and the municipal free library? On the opposing side, representing capitalist private enterprise, we have the health insurance industry, medical care, mortgages and student loans, agribusiness, oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, and 175 leaky nuclear power plants held together with duct tape. Parenti's talk is taken from a video available at dandelionsalad.wordpress.com. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Ilgitamai non carborundum, workers arise, and ciao.